Okay, if you'll find your way to Exodus chapter 20, we'll be ready to begin. Exodus chapter 20, I think it's verse 14. It's the seventh of the commandments. Last week we covered four words. This week we cover five words. Somebody read it. That's the one we did last week. That's 13. I think we're looking at 14. You shall not commit adultery. I think I've got five parts, and there's eight parts to the last part that we're going to talk about this morning, so we need to get going. If you look in Genesis chapter 2, you find something fascinating. God has completed creation in the first chapter, and after each part of creation, he pronounces it good. This is good, this is good, this is good, this is all very good. But in chapter 2, verse 18, he finds something about which to say, this is not good. What's that? It is not good for man to be alone. Now, I think it's okay to chuckle a little bit at what God does. Read the rest of the verse. It is not good that man should be alone, God said. This is not good. What's God going to do about it? What does he say? I'm going to make him a helper. And help meet, I think, is the way that King James puts it. Read the next three verses and tell me what God does. Read the next couple of verses. Tell me what God does. I'm going to make him a helper, God says. Right? What did he do? He starts making animals and brings them to him. And each one that he brings, the man names them, and that's going to be the name that they have. And then there's a judgment that's there. It's the tail end, I think, of verse 20. What does it say? No helper suitable for man, for the man was found for him. So at that point, he creates woman and brings her to the man. And verse 23 begins. A rough translation, a rough paraphrase of verse 23. God brought her to the man, and the man said, yippee. That's a rough paraphrase. Wow would be a pretty good one. There's something humorous about this. All the animals have come. All of them. But now a woman comes and the man says, whoopee, wow. And it goes on to say, this one at last. Your translation, I think, should at least have the phrase at last. It's bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. She will be called woman because she was taken from man. And then the judgment of the writer, this is why a man leaves his father and mother and becomes attached to his wife and they become one flesh. What is God's plan? God's plan is that man would not be alone and that part of what binds man and woman together is sex. Our subject this morning is sex. Have you figured that out yet? This is a tough morning. Because we're going to have to talk about some blunt things. There are some verses in the Bible that I border on blushing to read. No, you should not leave. You absolutely should not leave. You should be here. Okay? Dangerous ground is what it should say. Okay. Now, the Bible acknowledges that there will be temptation to carry sex in directions that it should not go. And if you want to see that most clearly, you go to Proverbs chapter 5. So guess what we're going to do? We're going to go to Proverbs chapter 5. When you get there, what you find is the Bible is depicting a man giving advice to his son, and all that you see is one-sided. The advice is being given to a son. The son is being told to be careful of women, and you don't see the inverse of that or the parallel to that. I think by implication it's there, and there's a few other places in the Bible where it is there. But That's the orientation with which we approach. The first eight verses picture the problem. My son, pay attention to my wisdom. Listen carefully to what I know, so that you may preserve discretion and your lips may guard knowledge. A different translation says, you will then be able to show discernment and your lips will express what you have learned. End of verse 2. Take no notice of a loose living woman, for the lips of the adulteress drip with honey. Her palate is more unctuous than oil, but in the end she is as bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death. Sheol is the goal of her steps. Far from following the path of life, her course is uncertain and she does not know it. That's the problem. And the problem cuts both ways. We're seeing one side of it. This is what a man faces when tempted by a woman. We're seeing one side of it. What is the recourse that the father offers to his son? Look at verse 8. What's the solution?
Stay away.
Stay away. Don't go there. And it's two parts. Stay away. Don't go there. Verse 9 begins to talk about the consequences. What happens if you do go there? My translation says, or she will hand over your honor to others. She will hand over the years of your life to someone who has no pity. Strangers will take over your property. Your produce will go to the house of a stranger. And at your ending, your body and flesh having been consumed, another translation says disease having consumed your body, we're seeing that in our day, you will groan and exclaim, alas, I hated discipline, my heart spurned all creation. I would not attend to the voice of my masters, I would not listen to those who tried to teach me, and now I have come to nearly every kind of misery in the assembly and the community. There is danger down this road. There is danger down this road. And the father is warning his son of that. Now, it's interesting that what's been laid out so far is the problem and the consequences. What should the father lay out? A solution. That starts in verse 15. And verse 15 is powerful. It is expressed in metaphoric imagery. What does it say? Drink water from your own well. Draw fresh water from your own spring. Look at the middle of verse 18. Let me see if I can find it on this other translation because it's a little better here. Let your wife be a fountain of blessing for you. Rejoice in the wife of your youth. I got a gift for Christmas. And the gift is a subscription to Netflix. And what I'm discovering is that on Netflix, there are some very old sitcoms that are still pretty funny. And one of those is Cheers. Y'all remember Cheers? I don't know who you think is the most fascinating character on Cheers, but I will tell you who the most sympathetic character is on Cheers. That's Coach. Y'all remember Coach? Clueless as the day is long. And one of the early episodes, I think it's episode 3 or 4, Coach's daughter comes in to tell him she's about to get married. And the guy that she brings into the bar for everybody to meet is a sleaze of the first order. And Coach finally gets her off in the office and asks her, what is she doing? And she says, look, I'm old, I'm not very pretty. I know I'm not going to have any chance. At least this guy wants to marry me. I know he's marrying me so he can get a promotion because I'm his boss and I've got control over the things that happen to him in his career. I know he's just using me, but I just want this chance. And I'm not very good looking. Coach looked at her and said, you are the most beautiful thing in the world. You look just like your mother. And your mother was beautiful until the day she died. There is a moment there where you start to capture what this is saying. There are things that are beautiful that the world does not acknowledge. There are things that are ugly that the world does not acknowledge as ugly. And the world often encourages us to get those out of whack. That was part one. Ready for part two? God draws a parallel between this kind of problem, adultery and such. He draws a parallel between that and people who are not faithful to Him, who have claimed to be His. You see this in the first 10 or 12 chapters of Hosea. We don't have time to read all of that, but you can also see it in Jeremiah in a more concentrated form. So see if you can find the book of Jeremiah. And we're going to look for verse for chapter 3.
Chapter what?
Chapter 3.
Are we done in Proverbs?
Yes. Actually, sure. You can find it again. I have faith. Poor Bill's negotiating two different electronic things. Raz, you finding this okay, brother? You doing all right?
It's the Zoom.
Not easy when it's 3 words per page.
Okay. Now, before we get too far into this, I need to try to orient you properly. Jeremiah was a prophet in the last days of the southern kingdom. After Solomon was king, the nation of Israel split into two parts. What was the name of the southern kingdom?
Judah.
What was the name of the northern kingdom? Israel. You need those two words. What happened to Israel? Israel's capital was Samaria. They lasted for a while, and the Assyrians wiped them out. Judah lasted another 100, 120 years, something like that, and then Babylon took them out. Jeremiah was prophet just before that came, and he was prophet through the time the Babylonians came in and took everybody off to captivity. The word of God is coming through Jeremiah. This is early in the book of Jeremiah, so this is pretty early in that time. Verse 6, in the days of King Josiah, the Lord said to me, this is Jeremiah speaking in first person, speaking of what God has said, quote, have you seen what disloyal Israel has done? Who's Israel? The northern kingdom. How she has made her way up every high hill and to every green tree and played the whore there. The language is blunt for what we're doing this morning. God continues, I thought after doing all this, she will come back to me, but she did not come back. Her faithless sister Judah saw this. She also saw that I had repudiated disloyal Israel for all her adulteries and given her her divorce papers. Her faithless sister Judah, however, was not afraid. She too went and played the whore, and with her shameless whoring, she polluted the whole country, committed adultery with stones and pieces of wood. Worse than all this, Judah, her faithless sister, has come back to me not in sincerity, but only in pretense, the Lord declares. And the Lord said to me, disloyal Israel is upright compared with faithless Judah. God uses the image of adultery and the breaking of faith that comes in a marriage partner arrangement with that. He parallels that with the spiritual consequences and the spiritual actions where people are supposed to be his children, but who ignore him and go off and do things that he says are wrong. Okay, that was part two. Ready for part three? What does God think about sex?
It is good.
It is. He likes it. He thinks it's a good thing. If you go through Genesis 5 or 6 or 7 times, at least 5 times, he says to people, go forth, be fruitful, and multiply. And his plan was that sex would be used that way. If you read what psychologists and sociologists and others say, you get a little hint of what was going on, though. Sex for human beings not only produces children, it also produces the bonds that hold married people together. And that was God's plan. That was God's plan. God blesses it in marriage. If you go back to that section in Proverbs, that's why I was hesitating about whether to let it go. If you look in verse 18 and 19, you find the writer saying, be captivated by the love you have had. Be captivated all your life. Sex isn't dirty. It isn't bad. It's beautiful and holy, but it's designed by God to be used within certain parameters, and those parameters are marriage. That was part three. I'm going to lose count pretty soon. I'll just say here's another part. But we're ready for part four. What did Jesus have to say about this commandment? Last week, I took you to Matthew chapter 5, the Sermon on the Mount. I want to take you back there, and I want to look at this commandment through that. So if you can find the book of Matthew, find chapter 5. We're going to go back to that section. I think it has six parts. We saw two or three of those parts last week. It always begins with, "You have heard it said of old," and he quotes something from the Old Testament, "but I say to you," and then he begins to talk about not reversing what's said in the Old Testament, but expanding and deepening your understanding of what the Old Testament was really talking about. We're looking at chapter 5. We're looking at verse 27. How does it start? "You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say this to you." And what does he say? "If you look at a woman lustfully, you have already committed adultery with her in your heart." And what follows seems so unbelievable to us that we want to take it out of our Bible. "If your right eye should be your downfall, tear it out and throw it away. For it will do you less harm to lose one part of yourself than to have your whole body thrown in hell. If your right hand should be your downfall, cut it off and throw it away. For it will do you less harm to lose one part of yourself than to have your whole body go to hell." Doesn't that sound horrible?
It does. And isn't it interesting when he's talking about adultery, and he talks about an eye and a hand and not a sex organ?
Doesn't he, though?
Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting?
Let me take you one step further. What do they do to you if you have cancer?
Yes.
What do they do to you if you have cancer?
The tumor.
Wherever the cancer is located, they cut that out of your body. Why? To have some hope of halting the spread. Jesus is making a parallel between lust and cancer. And I do find it fascinating that the focus is the eye and the hand and not the sex organ. That is a fascinating little sidebar. The bigger point to me is he's making an equality between cancer and cancer surgery. And that's the way you should see this. If I have cancer, I don't want to leave that in the body. There's somebody in the first hour who's going in for cancer surgery tomorrow morning. And part of his hope is that it hasn't spread. Why? So that when they cut that out, they'll catch it all. Jesus is equating this to cancer. He's equating what to cancer? Lust. So it seems like we ought to talk a little bit more about what lust means. I'll give you a definition. It's the desire to possess, the desire to have power over. The desire to possess or the desire to have power over. If you listen very carefully, you start to see the heart of it. And we're going to come back, I hope, and talk about this a little bit later. You are seeing someone or something as an object from which to derive pleasure, not as a person with whom to have a relationship of some kind. Now, to finish this thought, I want you to go 10 chapters further into Matthew, see if you can find Matthew chapter 15. We're going to start with verse 10 when you get there. Matthew 15, verse 10. Have I said that we're getting blunt this morning? I think I need to repeat that. We're going to get blunt here. Okay? It's all in the book. I haven't gotten to the parts that I blush to speak yet, but we will get somewhere close to them later. Verse 10. Jesus called the people to himself, and he said, "Listen and understand." What? I'm at verse 10 of Matthew 15. I hope I'm at verse 10 of Matthew 15. You're not there?
No, I wasn't.
There's been a week where all of you were in another place than me. This is not that week, I think. Okay, chapter 15, verse 10. Jesus called the people to himself and said, "Listen and understand. What goes into the mouth does not make anyone unclean. It's what comes out of the mouth that makes someone unclean." Now, there's some stuff that goes on in 12, 13, and 14. Come back to verse 15. Peter says to him, "Lord, explain this parable for us." And Jesus replied, "Even you don't understand it? And then he explains it. Can't you see, watch out, it's getting blunt, that whatever goes into the mouth passes through the stomach and is, now my translation gets very careful here, discharged into the sewer. How does yours read that last little part? Eliminated, yours says. Okay. I've heard somebody say that's why they call it the element eliminatory canal. They didn't get alimentary canal. They thought they were saying it. Eliminatory canal. What goes into the mouth passes through the stomach and is discharged into the sewer. But whatever comes out of the mouth comes from the heart. And that's what makes people unclean. Now look at his list that follows in verse 19. For from the heart come, here's my phrase, evil intentions. What does yours say? Yours says thoughts, and I don't think that's strong enough. It's not just thoughts. It's the imagining of action on those thoughts. Evil intentions. You may not have carried them out yet, but you're already thinking about carrying them out.
Evil
arguments, yours says. I still like intentions, I think. Now, what are those evil intentions? What's the first one? Go slowly here, guys. That was last week. What's the second one? That's this week. What's the third one? That's a variation on the second one. What's next? That's next week. Perjury and slander. That's the week after. He's hitting four of the big commandments that we're going to be dealing with. He leaves off covetousness, but he's got all the others. And variations on some of those. From the heart come evil intentions. Intentions that lead toward murder. Intentions that lead toward adultery or fornication. Intentions that lead toward theft. Intentions that lead toward perjury or slander. These are the things that make a person unclean. Eating with unwashed hands doesn't make anybody unclean. So there it is. Jimmy Carter is famous at this point. I will refrain from saying anything more than that. Some of you who are old enough know what I'm talking about. That's fine. Our world feeds lust in so many ways it's not funny. The clothes we are offered do it. The ads that we see. There's an ad for a car that's insane in this direction. The movies, the television shows, the magazines that we're offered. When we allow fantasy to grow, we violate this commandment. What are we called to? We are called to sexual purity inside and outside. The Old Testament looks at outside. Jesus looks at inside. We are called to purity. Part 5. Ready? Why does God make such a big deal out of this? The best I have ever heard anybody talk about this was Teresa McBean at a meeting of North Star. And it is the most unlikely verse to ever build anything like this out of. It's in Deuteronomy. And you got to go find it. You got to see it. It's in Deuteronomy chapter 23. As you're going there, I need to ask a question. How many of you have served in some capacity in the military? Okay, smaller number in this hour than in the first hour. How many of you have been Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts and have spent some time living outside? That's a few more, right? When people teach you how to live outside, they teach you certain things. When I was in the military, part of what I was issued was called an entrenching tool. It was this clever little thing that folded up on itself like this and could be locked that way, but it also could be taken to where it was sitting like this, in which case it could be a hoe or a rake kind of thing, and it could go like this and be locked in place, and it was a shovel. Everybody, you know what I'm talking about? Okay. What did you use an entrenching tool for? Well, you had a lot of uses for it. One use was to dig a slit trench or a latrine. Why did you do that? Because if you weren't careful, you could give everybody around you dysentery and all kinds of worse stuff if you weren't practicing some kind of sanitation with respect to the passing it to a sewer that we read about a little bit earlier, right? Okay. In that spirit, I begin at what I think is verse 12 in your translation. Chapter 23 of Deuteronomy. Chapter 23 of Deuteronomy. Do I need to give my electronic voice another one or two? Deuteronomy 23, I believe it's verse 12. Verse 12, you must have a latrine outside your camp. Have I found the right verse? Is it 12 or 13? Is that 12? You must have a latrine outside the camp, and you must go out to it, and implied is when it's time to do the things that you do in a latrine. You must have a trowel in your equipment. My translation calls it a trowel. I would have called it an entrenching tool. And when you squat outside, mine says, you must scrape a hole with it and turn around and cover up your, and my translation uses the word excrement. Everybody okay so far? That's the lead-in to the scripture lesson that formed the basis of Teresa's comments that day. You intrigued yet? Okay, watch the next verse. For the Lord your God goes about the inside of your camp to guard you and to put your enemies at your mercy. Your camp, therefore, must be a holy place. The Lord must not see there anything indecent, or you are at risk that he will desert you. The Lord your God goes about the inside of your camp. He must not see anything indecent there. Your camp must be a holy place, or you are at risk of God deserting you. Why does the Bible make a big deal about this? Because about God's very presence in our lives is hinging on our behavior in this area. Sexual purity, purity in general, but specifically sexual purity, and spiritual power are connected. God does not bless great talent. God blesses people who are holy. I want to take you to a couple of places.
Can I say something?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Or you could read that to say, then you just need to keep it well hidden from the Lord.
And I think it's
in our world. But I mean, as the world, as you just march through the world.
Go back and look at verse 12. Where does this stuff belong? Outside. Keep it out there. The filth that's out there around us. I talked to somebody in the first hour this morning and said something I probably said 100 times in the last 2 decades. If when my mother and father bought their first television, what was shown on that television was what is shown on my television today, they would have broken that television into small pieces and television would never have been adopted by our country. It's there, and I watch some of it. I'm not speaking here out of superiority. I'm speaking here with the same problems everybody else in this room has. That stuff is alluring. It's tempting. And what Bible is saying is, if there's going to have to be filth, keep it outside the camp. Not bring it inside the camp and cover it over. Get it out there and get it where you don't see it. I don't think I'm wrong, but I am translating verses 12 and 13 for you. The front end of this is there's going to be excrement around you of various kinds. It does not belong inside your camp. It belongs out there, and it belongs covered, out of sight. And that's hard. That's very, very hard. Turn to 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. Turn to 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. I want you to look first at verse 3. We were here the other day. Probably someday soon we'll be here again. Way back in the back, almost to Revelation. There's those little bitty books, 1 and 2 Timothy, 1 and 2 Thessalonians. Not in that order. I think Thessalonians is first. What does verse 3 say? God's will for you is that you be holy. Go to verse 7. Well, actually, just keep going with verse 3. He wants you to keep away from sexual immorality. He wants each one of you to know how to control his body in a way that is holy and honorable, not giving way to selfish lust like the nations who do not acknowledge God. Verse 7, God calls us to be holy, not to be immoral. Turn to Titus. That's about three little books towards Revelation. If you get to Hebrews, you went just a little too far. Titus chapter 2. And look at verse 14. Titus chapter 2, verse 14. He, that is Jesus offered himself for us in order to, and then it says two things. What's the first one?
Jesus.
Yours says redeem, mine says ransom us from our faults. And what's the second? To purify a people to be his very own, eager to do good things. Now, see if you can come back in between these two. See if you can come back in between these two to 1 Timothy chapter 5. And as you're doing so, let me try to help you understand what Titus was talking about. 1 Timothy chapter 5 is where you're headed. Titus was saying God's grace teaches us how to say no to the things we ought to say no to. And more importantly, teaches us how to say yes to the things we ought to say yes to. We'll say more about that in just a moment. Look at the first two verses of 1 Timothy chapter 5. The first two verses. 1 Timothy chapter 5, the first two verses. This works better in this area than in this hour than it did in the first hour. Did you read that first verse? It works better in here than it did in the other hour. You see why? Thank you. Never speak sharply to a man older than yourself, but appeal to him as you would your own father. And it goes on to say, treat younger men as brothers. Treat older women as mothers. Treat younger women as sisters. Mine says, with all propriety. Yours probably is translated better. What does it say? The best translation doesn't say all. It says absolute, with absolute purity. Let's keep going on this point. Why does the Bible make such a big deal about this? You found 1 Thessalonians and 1 Peter, right? Go to the other side of Hebrews and a book or two beyond, you find 1 and 2 Peter. Find 1 Peter chapter 2. You got to dig a little bit into this one to see what the Bible is saying. This is one we have seen before. We'll see it again someday. 1 Peter chapter 2, I want to start at verse 11. I urge you, my dear friends, as strangers and nomads on this earth, keep yourselves free from the disordered natural inclinations that attack the soul. How does yours translate what my Bible renders as disordered natural inclinations? Fleshly lust. It brings the word lust back in. Passions of the flesh. Keep yourself away from those things. Now look at verse 12. Always behave honorably among, my translation says Gentiles. Here's what I want you to put in place of that: among those who do not yet know the Lord. Always behave honorably among those who do not yet know the Lord, so that they can see for themselves what moral lives you lead, and when the day of reckoning comes, give thanks to God for the things which now make them denounce you as a criminal. Why does the Bible make such a big deal out of this? Because our witness is perverted and destroyed. The things that people see in godly people leading godly lives are the things the Spirit can use to open their heart to the witness about God. People are brought to God. If we do not do that, they won't be ready for the Spirit's work. Our effectiveness in witnessing is undermined if we are not living lives that are holy and pure. you're in 1 Peter now, right? Can you find 2 Peter? Second Peter is talking about false teachers. And down in the middle of this, 2 Peter chapter 2, this whole chapter talks about false teachers and some of the consequences. I can't read the whole chapter, there's not enough time. Let me jump into the middle of it. Verse 18. With their high-sounding but empty talk, they tempt back people who have scarcely escaped from those who live in error by playing on the disordered desires of their human nature and by debaucheries. This they may promise freedom, but they themselves are slaves to corruption, because if anyone lets himself be dominated by anything, he is a slave to it. Here's the thing. The third thing is sexual sin puts people into bondage, into slavery. And it doesn't matter, it seems, whether they're redeemed or lost. They're still slaves. Part 6, are we up to part 6? I think so. So, how do you deal with this? What do you do to try to either avoid the problem or to get out of it if you're trapped in it? Okay? And I've got, I think, 8 things to talk about, and I've got about 6 minutes, so that means we've got about 45 seconds each. All right, here's the first one. Way back in Proverbs, what did the father say to the son? Stay away, don't go there. That's point one. Run from it. Don't go near it. Treat it like Superman treats kryptonite. Stay away. It's a whole lot easier to deal with temptation by never going to where the temptation is. Do you know where the most active money is spent on pornography anywhere in the country? This may be approaching no longer being true, but it was true a decade ago. More money was spent on pornography in hotels in the United States than anywhere else. A lot of hotels, much of the money they make is made off of the movies that they run on the in-store, in the in-room camera, televisions. Call the desk. Disable the access. Number 2, and this one I think is probably the most powerful thing I know of. Turn to Job chapter 31. Job is talking to his friends, and what he says is fascinating. What he says is fascinating. The New Living Translation, I think, has the best translation of this, at least for the first part. Chapter 31, Job chapter 31. I need the very first verse. Job is speaking to his friends, and he tells them, I'm putting 2 or 3 translations together here, I have made a covenant with my eyes not to linger lustfully on young women or on a young woman. I have made a covenant with my eyes not to let my eyes linger. And then one translation says linger lustfully on a young woman.
The message says never to undress.
I've got a note here. I remember somebody talking about this who said, women, you could really help us men by being more modest in your dress. About 3 weeks ago, one of my students came to my office. She had been invited to go to a function of our business school where they were going to teach them how to comport themselves in a business setting. They had been instructed to wear business dress. She was standing in my office with a skirt that came to here and was cut to here. As I put it to the first hour, she had some pretty impressive charms, and much of her charms were on display. And she said, is this what they mean by business dress? I wasn't clever enough to think of that response. I just said something more simple. I said, no.
Praise God.
I said, no. I told her, I said, one of the things you can do is whatever you wear, look around you at this place and see if you can figure out what business dress is. But I said, the first thing business dress is, you don't offer distractions to the people you're trying to do business with. I think, Bruce, yours would have been a cleverer response, but I wasn't that quick. Women, you could help us men at this point.
And I think, too, dads, I know my husband, Dennis, he names it with them, and I think that's helpful.
I think a lot of our little girls don't have that.
Well, Dennis wasn't raised with girls, but I said, you need to do this as a dad, and he has started it since they were little, and he doesn't really have to do it now because they know the standards, but if it's, I just think it's important for dads.
She's kind of on many occasions a bit like, Mom, I'm the modest one. I'm the mother in the group. I'm telling them, no, if I can see your belly button. That's what we've told them. There's a mirror to it.
Your turn, Barbara.
Having just come back from Thailand, that is not an issue in that country. I think this is in our country.
Right.
They dress modestly. They dress modestly.
I will tell you that Kimberly has really struggled to find clothes to purchase that are appropriate and are modest sufficient. She would like to have something a little bit more coverage, and it can be a significant challenge to still be to dress what is considered stylishly among that age group and still cover themselves.
1 Corinthians 15:33, we are approaching the end. 1 Corinthians 15:3. If you found 1 Thessalonians a little while ago, it's about four books before that. 1 Corinthians 15:33. I'm pulling some stuff out of context, but it works. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 34. I don't know what I said, but verse 34. Watch where your mind goes. Control what you let into your mind. Here goes verse 34. Do not let anyone lead you astray. Bad company corrupts good intentions. He's actually quoting from one of the Greek philosophers at this point, or quoting from a play that was being produced in his day. Bad company corrupts good intentions. We don't have to go looking for things to be lustful over. They come looking for us. Sort of on that same point, I won't take time to take you there, but Psalm 119:11 says, "Thy word have I hid in my heart in order that I might not sin against you." If you fill your life with good things, there won't be room for bad things. The key is not to get rid of bad things. The key is to drive the bad things out by putting good things in their place. We've said this almost every week. I need to say it again. Most human beings, I think all human beings, are incapable of doing this alone. Without the Spirit's help, this won't work. And one way that the Spirit can help is to have somebody that you treat as someone who's holding you accountable. Sin hates light. And by having someone else who's looking into your life, shining light into your life, sometimes that's enough to be the key. God, in partner with a trusted Christian brother or sister, pastor, a friend, sometimes that can help.
So my wife does for me. She keeps that light on.
There's a book called Joel. It's buried in the middle of the minor prophets. They're called the little books that end the New Testament. He's talking about locusts having been sent into the country. But he says this, when the locusts are gone, I will make up to you the years devoured by the locusts, the great army that I sent to invade you. The promise that God makes there is, if you take the step of reclaiming integrity in this part of your life, He will give you back some of the things that you have lost. Reclaiming the integrity in this area of life. You've heard the pastor say maybe 7 weeks ago, from today, my life will be this, not that. That's all I have for you today. We've had some pretty tough things to talk about. Let me pray as we go. Our Father, we thank you for the time you give us. We thank you for giving us hard things to think about. We realize in this particular area, our world has turned pretty sick. We suspect the sickness has always been there. It just feels like it's been let loose to levels that were unimaginable in years before. So I pray that you would work with each person in this room, with each person connected with each person in this room, for those who worship in this place and for those they connect to bring your spirit to an active level in our lives so that we may live lives that are more holy, more pure, more consistent with who you are and with our gratitude to you for having saved us and guiding us. All this we pray in your Son's name. Amen.